I'm going to talk about fluid membranes, okay, from a mesoscopic point of view. Okay, on these scales, the membrane can be described as a geometrical surface. Okay, the bending energy determining the surface is essentially a geometrical bending energy. What this implies is that the stresses which lie in the membrane are completely determined by geometry. Okay, so it's a problem of interest to the theoretical physicists interested in field theory and to mathematicians interested in differential geometry. Okay, so I'll have to give some background geometry to make sense of this. Okay, and somewhere in here I'll talk about how translation invariance implies a conserved stress tensor. This is not modern mathematics. This is Noether's theorem, which is 19th century differential geometry, 19th century differential equations theory. But it's a far more efficient way than using traditional engineering techniques and Newtonian mechanics to obtain conserved stress tensor. Using this tensor, then I'll be able to talk about interactions between particles that are mediated by the geometry of the gel. I'm going to assume that the membrane is a pure fluid membrane. I'm going to forget about proteins, cytoskeleton, everything else. Okay, and you see how despite all of its heavy formulas, and very, very simple tools come out. Okay, can be used and applied without knowing where it all came from. I hope to convince you of that. Okay, another thing I'm interested in is in the inverse problem. Geometry tells us where the stresses lie, but also like to some extent, the converse is true. That if we know what the stresses are, we can say something about the geometry. Okay. So just forgive this sort of very, very low tech talk. Okay, because I'm not a PowerPoint or anything person, a Blackboard person. But this Blackboard doesn't lend itself to being erased. So anyway, I want to motivate why they are to be treated as geometrical surfaces, okay? So what is a fluid membrane? Everybody here probably knows that it consists of a bilayer of vacuophilic molecules with self-assembling water, okay? The polar head of this molecule faces water, the hydrocarbon chains shield themselves from the water, okay, in this bilayer. The formation of these membranes is completely driven by entropy. This is because the bilayer, despite appearances, has far more entropy than the exposed chains. This is because water will form cages around these chains, as we learned last week in the tutorials. Okay, what about the sizes? How can we get this geometrically? The head diameter of these is about a nanometer in diameter. The length of the chains is about 5 nanometers. So that for a spherical vesicle of radius 5 microns, okay, we'll have about 10 to the 8 molecules. And the thickness of the membrane is much less than the radius of curvature of this vesicle by a factor of 1,000. Okay, so on these scales, this is a standard practice in field theory, we can approximate the membrane as a geometrical surface. What about the mechanical properties of the surface? But as long as the amphiphilic molecules remain within the bilayer, we can move them around. Okay, the shear modulus of this material is essentially zero. This implies that it acts like a two-dimensional fluid. We want to incorporate this into the model. Okay. Secondly, these membranes are essentially incompressible. That's because the cost of introducing a lipid is a few k Boltzmann times temperature. So that to increase the size of the cell by the membrane by 1% will cost up to 10 to the 6 kT. Okay? By comparison, bending is very, very cheap. Okay? That's because if we bend the membrane into a sphere of radius r, the bending energy per unit is also just a few kT, but this time over r squared. Okay, so that for the whole surface of this sphere, we only have a bending total energy of about 100 kT as compared to 10 to the 6. Okay, so that these materials are very, very soft. Okay, thermal fluctuations are important. But having paid lip service to thermal fluctuations, I would basically know, because I'm going to look at classical physics. Okay, because in some sense, what the story is complicated enough as it is. Okay, so the summary of this is that on micron scales, we have a soft, incompressible fluid. Okay, and we can also say that the microscopic physics for all the complications of these molecules, okay, all the complicated chemistry, it telescopes into a few parameters, one or more rigidity parameters, tension, etc. The interesting thing is bending is purely geometrical. The free energy described in the system depends only on the geometry. Okay? And an interesting property is we see this 1 over r squared per unit area, we're multiplying by r squared, bending energy is scale invariant. That's very, very important for the properties of these systems. So I'm interested in stresses, okay? This geometry, because the free energy is completely geometric, electrical, basically how the energy just responds to deformations tells us what the stresses are. So that tells the geometry completely tells us what the physical stresses underlying it are. Okay, tells us what are the stresses that underpin it. Okay, so there are three things I'd like to talk about. I'm imitating Marcus here. Four pieces. So I want to understand the nature of this relationship. I'd like to put it to use. Okay, so how can we put it to use? In equilibrium, the stresses are conserved. Okay. And basically, the stress is conserved on the surface. This tells us that forces and particles will get transmitted across closed curves. Okay, this is something like the analog of Gauss's law for two-dimensional surfaces of Gauss's law in electrostatics. Okay, it's very, very simple, just a little bit difficult or a little bit subtle to implement it. Okay, and the other thing is that the geometry on these curves determines the forces completely. Traditionally in this field, when people want to determine forces, what they do is to differentiate energies. To determine the energy, you have to know what the geometry is everywhere. Here it's far, far more economical. All we need is the geometry on a single closed curve surrounding the particle to know how it's going to respond. So there are applications for protein-protein interactions. By that I mean geometrically mediated interactions. For example, things like the Golgi. What are the forces tugging on it to keep it in this sort of very, very convoluted geometry? And to Marcus and other people in mindset have done, you can use it for analysing AFM experiments. Okay? And then the third part of this talk, if I get there, will be to look at this converse problem that I mentioned. Okay? So let me go back. Okay, this is like sort of geometry 101. So I'm going to describe as closed surface in parametric form. So it's three functions, these are capital X's, are three functions of two parameters. Okay? I can cut the tangent vector. This is the partial derivative with respect to the parameter u1 and u2. Okay, these can be the two tangent vectors. And then with these, I can construct a normal vector. Okay, so now I have a basis of vectors constructed at every point on the surface. Okay, there are two surface tensors. Okay, it might sound horrible, but the most efficient way to discuss them, and I worked in relativity, and I mathematicians tend not to shy away as well from tensor analysis in terms of differential favor of differential forms, but if you have a geometrical problem and you want to calculate anything, tensor analysis is the way to do it. Anyway, there are two tensors. One is the induced metric. Okay, this tells us what the distances are, okay, completely. And it tells us completely characterizes the intrinsic geometry of the surface. There's another tensor which is important, which tells us about the extrinsic properties, how it bends in space. That's the extrinsic curvature. Okay, I'll motivate this definition in a second, but the more familiar Monge representation that most people here, mathematically inclined people will know, is that one can describe the surface as a height, both a plane, a height function, okay? The curvature is given by the Hessian or the second derivatives of the height function with respect to the parameters, okay? I say that this is not strictly true, this is true when I tilt the base plane so that the tangent is parallel to the base plane at the point. Okay. There is a modern way of looking at these, of introducing all of these concepts into one. And these are the structural equations. The first of them was recognized by Gauss at the beginning of the 19th century. But we want to look at how do the tangent vectors vary as I roam over the surface, okay? So what I do is I look at the derivatives of the tangent vectors. And this itself is a vector in space, so I can expand it as a linear combination of my basis, the tangent vectors and the normal. These coefficients are the so-called Christoffel symbols, okay? And this, the normal projection is in fact a tensor. What one can do is one can bring this over to the right-hand side, to the left-hand side, okay? And define what's called a covariant derivative. This is the geometrically significant derivative on the surface. These things don't. If I just take ordinary derivatives of vectors on surfaces, I get rubbish, okay? As far as transformation properties. This tells me that basically the invariant information of how the tangent vectors change as they move over the surface. This is the curvature. Similarly, because the normal is orthogonal to the tangent vectors, we get that the normal varies in a way also proportional to this curvature tensor. These are the Gauss-Weingarten equations. If you read Spivak's book, they're described in volume 3. This five-volume set, okay? Interestingly here, from these one can get all of the curvature, all of the, a lot of information. One of the things, we have these derivatives, ordinary derivatives commute, but the real, the geometrically significant derivatives do not commute on the surface. If we look at the extent to which they fail to commute, okay, we get an idea of curvature, which is purely, these are purely intrinsic, because these coefficients are purely intrinsic. This is the Gaussian curvature, okay? And when we do this on both sides of these two equations, we find that this intrinsic curvature is given by the determinant of the extrinsic curvature. This is Gauss's theorem, egregious theorem, they were so happy with. Okay. There's another one which is associated with the normal, with the Weingarten equation, and it just tells me that the curvature tensor minus its trace, C, I'm using the notation C for the trace of this tensor, that this is a divergence-free tensor. Okay. So what we have is we have got two, the metric is conserved. That's another property of this covariant derivative. The metric is conserved, it's divergence free, and also this combination of the curvature tensor is divergence free on the surface.
One stupid question, I
guess.
The first of those I sort of understand. You're telling me if I walk on the surface this way, then that way,
yeah.
It's not the same as if I go that way, then this way.
Yes.
What is the, is there some simple picture I can have for what the second equation is
the
telling
second,
me?
The second equation, this is this one. This one.
No, down. Your integrability, you know, so
this
you
one.
Understand
this,
the non-kid.
This, okay, let me tell you what it is. For the surface, I've got three functions. Okay, x, y, z, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I have three metric components. I have a 2x2 symmetric tensor, and I have three curvature tensors. So I have 6 degrees of freedom. They cannot all be independent.
Okay.
But it's telling me that there are three integrability conditions on them to make them consistent with the initial function x. Okay, so three x's, there are three metric coefficients and there are three curvature coefficients. There's one constraint and there are two constraints here. That's what it is, okay?
Okay.
It's compatibility. So what we're going to do is we start off with x's, we're going to replace them by the g's and the curvatures, but in the process we have to remember that they're not independent,
they're
constrained,
okay?
That's the story, okay? It's sort of involved, but it's actually very, very useful. Okay, so what we want to do now is to construct a free energy, I'll call it a Hamiltonian here, okay, out of the geometry, okay. So we want one, it has to be invariant, we want it to be invariant under parameterization, so meanings of a dependence explicitly on the parameterization. And the easiest one, it's a little bit of thought tells us that it has to be, this is the area is constructed with the metric, by some scalar which is constructed with the metric and the curvature. So how do we identify the bending energy? So the bending energy is quadratic in curvature, okay? And quadratic curvature scalars can be constructed from the two invariants of a 2x2 symmetric matrix. They're the trace and its determinant, okay? The trace tells us how fast the area changes if we deform the surface normally, okay? So C is zero, these are called minimal surfaces. C is constant, the Laplace law for soap films, okay? The other, the Gaussian curvature, is a measure of how far we deviate from flatness, okay? And remarkably, there's an amazing result. Again, Gauss had his hand in it as well, again. And it's that the integral of the Gaussian curvature over a closed surface is a topological invariant. In other words, there's no local information contained in this second curvature. So the modulo topology or boundary conditions, there is unique bending energy for a surface, okay? And that's, we can choose it to be given by integrated mean curvature squared over the surface, okay? This is all well known, but it allows me to establish my notation sum, okay? If there's an asymmetry, after all, our membrane consists of two layers, not a single layer, okay? Then there may be an asymmetry between the two layers, okay? But there may be a difference in area. If I integrate the mean curvature over the area of the surface, that a measure of the difference in the area of the two layers. Okay. In fact, it is possible that for a closed membrane, that the inner leaf might have greater area than the outer one. Okay. For example, if I take something like an orange or a golf ball and I make dimples on it, I make the dimples deep enough, I can actually make the inner surface have a greater area. Okay. Funnily enough, when people in the 90s studied the phase diagrams of these models, everybody just truncated the phase diagrams. Ask mean this integrated mean curvature equal to zero. So one sees lots of interesting behavior happening. z goes to zero. People, for some strange reason, didn't pursue them beyond that line. Okay. So there will also be, typically there'll be a penalty associated with the area that it may be constrained. If it's a closed vesicle, the interior volume will be fixed, and we might have a constraint or a penalty on the integrated mean curvature. Okay. So the next thing we need to do is, if we want to talk about stress, and we need to know how this object deforms, how it responds to a small deformation of the surface. Okay. So let me show you one way of doing this. This is the sort of straightforward. It's not entirely clear. One can learn things about the surface by doing this, and then I'll do it another way. Okay. So I want to know how my Hamiltonian responds to a smaller deformation of the surface. So here's my surface. It's described by these three functions. I'm going to deform them a little bit. Okay. So this is a vector in space. So I can expand this vector in space into tangential part and a normal part. Okay. So the tangential vector, remember, are just derivatives of the axis. Okay. And so if we just look at the tangential part of this, we see immediately the tangential deformation of x is just of this form. And if we think about it, that is just what you would expect from a change. If I just change the parameter on the surface, that is infinitesimally exactly what you get from the tangential deformation. Okay? So the tangential deformation simply corresponds at first order to a change of parameter. One can follow through how this affects the surface tensor. So for example, one evaluates how the G responds to tangential deformation. And we get this, it's called a knee derivative, okay? It's a symmetric combination of covariant derivatives of the phi. Okay? This is a hallmark of just the behavior under repremerizations. One can follow this through in all the tensors appearing in my scalar Hamiltonian. And one finds that the tangential deformation, as one would expect, turns out to be just a divergence. Okay? So on a closed surface, there's no tangential effect. Okay? There's no effect. Tangential deformation is zero. Okay? So if you're looking for equilibrium properties of the surface, parallel part of this plays no role in determining the equilibrium. Okay? There is a curious thing here, one could make a mistake and say, at second order, if I looked at the tangential deformations, is that just a change of parameter? And in fact, it's not. In the 19th century, in the end of the 19th century, people like Backlund, Bianchi, and others, they looked at the pseudosphere, which is a constant negative Gaussian curvature, and they tried to generate new solutions from that by deforming it tangentially. Okay? Obviously, they are new and physically distinct solutions, but they're only physically distinct at quadratic and higher order. So the interesting deformations are normal ones. Okay? So the bulk change in the energy is completely determined by the normal deformation. Okay? So we can immediately say that the Euler-Lagrange derivative, which determines this response, okay, with respect to the surface x, is purely normal. Okay. To actually evaluate this, one needs to trace one way. Show in a moment how to shortcut this. One needs to follow to determine, given delta x, the normal deformation of x, one determines how g responds, the metric, and the curvature responds to a normal deformation of the surface. Okay, and they're very, very simple. The metric just reproduces the extrinsic curvature by how far it has moved normally. That's why I say when the area, I want to work out how the area changes when I deform a surface normally. Okay, the area is the determinant of this g. It goes as the trace of this. The trace of the curvature is a measure of how area deforms normally. The curvature transforms in a rather more complicated way, but it's not impossibly complicated. One would have expected something rather more dramatic. Okay, it's given by a Hessian, a second derivative, covariant. These are covariant derivatives. If I write these in terms of old partial derivatives, these are a mess. You've got one page to write that down, okay? I promise, okay? Mm-hmm. And these also are rather complicated, if I wrote them in a non-covariant or non-invariant way, okay? So it's just, there's a second derivative of the normal displacement. This is the distance I have deformed the surface in the normal direction, plus a massed kind of term. This is a symmetric term, okay? So with these, we can now sort of determine how H responds. Okay, so in one workout, the Euler Lagrange derivative for my bending energy Hamiltonian is just this. If there are constraints, you get two extra terms. Okay, so get this equation. People who are used to linearizing this, there's it's just the biharmonic equation.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The gradient there now. What is it? Covariant.
It's covariant. It's covariant. Okay, so it depends on x. It's very, very complicated. This way, the geometrical niche of the problem is sort of.
How do I write it in terms of those?
I've written it like this. It's this. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I can bring this up. Well.
No, that's fine.
I'm leaving out some of the story. Okay.
Okay.
Where did beta and sigma come in?
These are constraints. If I want to implement constraints on M on the integrated curvature, okay. I put a Lagrange multiplier on the area.
One question, please. This description allows deformation when you get a non-smooth surface or a cuspidal point.
Well, one has to be careful, okay? One has to be careful what you're collecting here, okay? Of course, if we apply external forces, there will be cusps, there will be discontinuities in the geometry. That's why we do have to be careful, yes. Okay, this is a fourth order non-linear elliptic PD. People who are used to looking at the linearized theory, okay? If one uses Monge gauge, one can write on bending energy as this, as the Laplacian of h squared, okay? And then the other Lagrange equation is just the Laplacian squared, okay? And one ignores all of these cubics. These are actually very, very important for looking at the shapes, sort of the complicated shapes, which aren't close to a plane, okay? It's cubic in curvature. And as equations go in theoretical physics, this is a remarkably subtle and complicated equation. It's comparable in difficulty to Einstein's equation of general relativity. It's certainly more complicated than Yang-Mills equations in the theory of electro, at a classical level. Obviously, people are interested in quantum problems. Okay, but then again, one is also interested in the statistical mechanics of the system. And as far as I know, no progress whatsoever has been made outside of the Lemy regime expanding in height.
What is the constraint that the average curvature?
This would tell me that I want to fix the difference between the areas and between these. Okay, you don't need to. What? There's another model that's called the bilayer coupler model. There's another model whereby one can use what's called spontaneous curvature. But instead of taking c, the curvature, one takes c minus the constant squared. Okay. This will induce a term linear in the curvature in the end. Okay? One penalizes the difference between some preferred curvature. This is the model, preferred by Helfrich and others. Okay. I don't know, for some sentimental reason I go for the constraint model.
But it just generates some term linear.
It's a term linear. I'm not going to discuss for my purposes here, the examples thing will be so trivial that they won't. Okay? So at this level, it looks like we just have geometry. So where are the forces? It's not obvious in this language at all where forces arise and how to describe them. Okay? So one needs to introduce some kind of an alternative strategy. Okay? So, and to motivate it, let's look at how the Hamiltonian gets constructed. Okay? So it depends on the surface only through the metric and the curvature. And they in turn are constructed from x through the tangent vectors and the normal. Okay? So what we can do is one can try to do is there are certain structural constraints between all of these variables, x, e, n, g, and c. The tangent vectors are just derivatives of the configuration vector. The normal is normal, it's unit normal in this language. The metric is just the inner product of two tangent vectors. And the curvature is just the projection of the change in the normal onto the tangents. Okay? So what we could do is if we impose all of these constraints using Lagrange multipliers, we can treat them all as independent variables. Okay? But actually we can do a lot more than that, okay? Because we can also use Noether's theorem. Okay, And so Noether's theorem tells us that if we have a global symmetry, then there's a conservation law. Or in this case, it's amazing, sort of, one doesn't have to know anything about solid mechanics or elasticity theory. Basically, the translation invariance of this Hamiltonian tells me that there was a conserved stress tensor. And it essentially tells me how to construct it. Okay? So I'll do that now. So let me do this. So here's my original Hamiltonian. And I'm going to treat it as a function of the metric and the curvature and nothing else. Okay? There's no x in here. I'm going to impose that this is the constraint that the tangent vector is the derivative of the configuration, the normalcy condition, the unit normal condition, the definition of curvature, and the definition of the metric. And they're all going to be imposed using Lagrange multipliers. Okay? The amazing thing about, well, amazing, what's nice about this, is translation invariance tells me that the only place where x appears in this constrained Hamiltonian is in the constraint up here. Okay? So we want to work out how does this Hamiltonian respond to a deformation in the configuration? Okay? We get a derivative of a delta x, and then we pass the delta x into integration by parts and pass it on to the f. And when we do that, we get a covariant derivative of f. Okay? So in equilibrium, where this is zero, this multiplier is conserved. Okay? And so if there are external sources within this closed curve, then we can use Gauss's theorem, okay, to say that what external force there is has to be a closed line integral on the surface. So I have a source in here and I have a curve here. Okay, this is a closed line integral of a projection of the stress tensor. L here is a vector tangential to the surface, but normal to this curve gamma. Okay, this is exactly what you do in elasticity theory, but now you're doing it on a curved surface. And this is exact, given the Hamiltonian, there'd be no approximation, we haven't had to go linear, and we haven't had to use any parameterization. There's completely parameterization invariant in this description up to now. Okay? So this, I'll say a little bit more about it, it's the stress tensor. Okay? In fact, you want to write an F as a vector in space and has a surface component. If you want to write it, you can write it as an Fi, these are the space components and these are the surface components. Okay? Just like a stress tensor in three-dimensional, in a bulk three-dimensional solid, but missing its normal components, okay? And normal well, okay? So this is the stress tensor. And the interesting thing here, we immediately see that the forces, whatever effect this external force on the membrane has, it has to be transmitted across that closed curve. Okay? Sort of obvious, but in some sense it's very, very powerful. So we still need to construct F. I've just said it's a Lagrange multiplier, okay? But the construction actually proceeds quite nicely, okay? So I rewrite this. Here's my constrained object, okay? So what are the deformations? We're ready to take in the variation with respect to x. Now let's do it with respect to the tangent vector, okay? So the tangent vector, here it appears, just essentially what it does is it tells what the stress is in terms of the tangent vectors and the normal vectors. It's a linear combination of the two. The coefficient, so E appears here, it appears here, this gives us this term here, okay, it appears here, we use the structure equations to give us this term here, and it appears here, which gives us the lambda, okay? The equation for N, on the other hand, tells us that this coefficient is not independent, it's just a covariant derivative of that multiplier, okay? So when we've done this, we find that we've expressed the stress as a sum of generalized forces. It's exactly sort of what people did when they introduced calculated variations in the beginning. Okay? And this structure, I still have not specified what the Hamiltonian is. It's completely model independent. So you give me your favorite Hamiltonian, I can write down what the stress is, corresponds to it. Okay, so this form, we're still not complete. We still have two more variations to take. We express the stress in terms of generalized forces. There still remains to determine the two independent multipliers. There's the multiplier lambda, which enforces that tells us what the curvature is, and small lambdas, which tell us what the metric is. So we need to take the equations of motion for them, or not equations of motion, the equilibrium conditions for them. And for the curvature, the equation, the equilibrium equation for the curvature just tells us what this multiplier is, okay? Because curvature only appears here and in the original Hamiltonian. So it tells us that this multiplier is exactly the Euler-Lagrange derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the curvature. Similarly, for this metric, metric only appears here and in the original, so it tells me that this multiplier is again proportional to the Euler-Lagrange derivative of the Hamiltonian. And this, people have studied metric theory, spring theory, gravity theory, whatever. The derivative of a Hamiltonian spectral metric tensor is the metric stress tensor. Okay? So in this case, because of the extrinsic geometry, it's not conserved. Okay? People who work in gravity are far more familiar with a metric stress tensor, which is conserved. Okay? So let me just summarize. When I put everything in, this is the final expression. Stresses. This is the metric stress tensor, which is just given by the derivative of treating G and the curvature as independent variables. It's given by the metric stress tensor and by the Euler-Lagrange derivative of the Hamiltonian respect to curvature. Okay, so it's a simple expression. It can be written down in one line. Now, to expand it out, it's quite a horrible-looking expression. Okay, so in equilibrium, the stress is conserved. Okay. All I can tell you is that if we go linear, or we go to Monge gauge, this structure is mutilated completely. It's unrecognizable. So I think Evan Evans in the early 80s, sort of heroic and a beautiful book, but he goes linear, and you don't really see how simple this expression is. Okay. So let me just see, how does this go? In the case of soap, okay, so just look, let's say my Hamiltonian is proportional to the area. Then all of the structure comes back. There's no dependence on curvature, so H is zero. The metric stress tensor, there's the derivative of area with respect to the metric, gives us back the metric, okay? This basically tells us that the stresses on the soap film are always isotropic. If the stress proportional to the metric has a perfect fluid, then it's the forces are isotropic. So one just gets that the stress tensor is this form, okay? I haven't stated explicitly, but this is the inverse metric. I can raise indices, so I get something that's proportional to the tangent vector itself. Okay. In equilibrium, this is conserved. And that just reproduces the condition that a soap film without a Laplace force due to a pressure difference across the membrane, across the film, that the mean curvature is zero. So it comes out very, very quickly in this language. This is the most trivial example one can have. Comment here is that in this structure, this is in general, this is not, this T is by construction symmetric tensor. This is not generally symmetric, okay? And there are interesting issues associated with this, which I won't have time to go into. Okay. So let me just go quickly on to how the force in a particle, okay? So the force in a particle will be just given by, I have a particle in here, okay, imagine that, okay? The force on that particle, which is given in, if the membrane is in equilibrium, will be given by evaluating this projection of the stress tensor along a closed curve on the membrane which surrounds the particle. Okay. One can always, if one likes, one can expand this the density here in terms of a part which is tangential. So this part is tangential to the curve, a part which is normal to the surface. Part which is normal to the curve but on the surface, okay, L. Okay. And then we see that this decomposes into three parts, an expansion, a shear part, even though we didn't have shear to start with in this model, okay? In some sense, if there are constraints, there can be shears, effective shears on the membrane, and a bending part, the normal part describes the bending, okay? This expression is completely valid, it's valid in the nonlinear regime, and it's manifestly independent of the parameterization. Okay? The other thing is that if we have a symmetry in the problem, we don't want to evaluate along any curve. What we can always do, if we have nice simple boundary conditions, we can contract the curve onto the boundary. And often the boundaries are not nice. Often we have a symmetry to exploit. What we can do is we can deform the contour to exploit the symmetry. Okay, and I'll just do that in a minute. So again, I emphasize force or transmitted across closed curves. Okay. And again, this is not obvious if one takes the energy. Say, I want to have two particles, one here and one there, and I want to differentiate the energy with respect to the distance. It's not at all obvious that is the case. Okay. So this formula, without doing any hard calculations, no numerics or anything, we can make some qualitative and quantitative predictions in this in the fully nonlinear regime. Okay. So let me show how look at a special case that I studied with Marcus, okay? Marcus de Cerno and the student to Martin and Muller in Mainz. Marcus will be talking after me. I don't think you're not going to talk about, you're not going to touch on this at all. I want to show you the different levels of this usual picture after you do it, okay? So this is a picture generated using a surface evolver, okay? So we think if we have two particles on a membrane, it doesn't really matter, but I'm going to specialize just for now for surface tension. Okay, imagine they might be pinned or somehow so they get a non-trivial contour, non-trivial boundary conditions, okay? So this problem has symmetry in the x-axis. And the membrane is asymptotically flat. Okay. So we imagine we somehow, just like in electrostatics, we hold the particles and then we let them go. So what's the force of these particles? Okay.
Can you explain a little bit more how to think about the particles? Like, are they going through the membrane? Are they resting on the membrane?
One would think of it that in this particular model, one was looking at a particle adhering to the membrane. Okay. So they're not exactly nanoscale particles, okay?
But
so it's particles. There's a contact line, okay? So you're not seeing it. There's a contact, okay? But it doesn't matter.
Okay.
The whole issue here is that it does not matter what's happening here at all.
Okay.
The model, that's the that's physics that you're going to have to put in, okay? I'm just saying that once I know the geometry, I'm going to determine, okay? But I can still say, without knowing any of these details, I'll show you that I can make predictions. Just based on the geometry.
Okay,
so
the minimal thing is that the particles alter the geometry of the membrane.
Yes.
And that causes a force between them that's transmitted through this deformation of the surface.
Yes, right, exactly.
And you're going to calculate.
I'm
going to
calculate the forces in two different simple cases. Firstly, I'll do it for surface tension, and secondly, I'll do it for bending energy. Okay. So it's given by a closed contour surrounding one of the particles. Okay. And now I've used that in this region here, the stress is conserved. Okay? So I can always deform the contour, okay? And in particular I can deform it so that one of its legs coincides with the symmetry axis. Okay? And then I form a square and I let the legs of this square go to infinity. Okay? So when I do that, unfortunately, I can't have them simultaneously in my low-tech way. I have this contour, okay? And then I'm going to find that the force, by symmetry, the force is along the x-axis, okay? And I do that. And if I work out with the stress tensor, if I work out what this force is, it's just proportional to the normal vector to the curve on the surface integrated along the contour, okay? It's quite easy to see that the force is just proportional to the area difference, okay? The added length along the contour along the axis of symmetry. Okay. So in other words, there's a definite prediction here. If I have a symmetrical situation where only surface tension is involved, the particles will always attract. It doesn't matter how they're bound, it doesn't matter what the boundary conditions are, it will always attract. Okay? Because the length will always be added to the contour due to the deformation of the membrane. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Funnily enough, this is a result that, to our knowledge, was unknown. Okay. People, when they look at these problems, they linearize, they evaluate the energy, and they differentiate. Okay. This is completely valid in the nonlinear. We never had to do any calculations really. Okay. And it's a very cheap prediction. Okay. So it's very insensitive. The details. We never needed to know, again to answer your question, we never needed to know the geometry of what's happening at the particles themselves, okay? And it stands in stark contrast to what one does with energy minimization.
So L is the tangent vector to your curve.
That's right.
It's just in the y
direction. L is the normal to the curve.
Oh,
along
the curve,
so
it's in the x direction.
Yes. Along that leg on that segment of the contour, it is along the x axis, okay?
But then if I change the length of my contour, why is the answer independent of the shape of the contour? I mean, everything else came out of the integral.
Yes.
So if I deform the contour now, I may get a different answer, won't I?
No.
Because I get, because it's compensated on
it's
the
it's compensated.
Three
with the compensation
other
on the other side.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Huh. Oh, because you have to get back where you started from. It has to be closed. It's
yes.
Okay.
So with bending, it's a little bit more difficult story. So I'm going to take the bending energy with these constraints, okay? And this time, the stress tensor, I'll write it out again as a tangential part and a normal part. So this tangential stress tensor is quadratic in the curvature, okay? This is the tension part, isotropic tension part. But now we see that it depends explicitly on the curvature tensor. Here, quadratically, so it's bending energy as a stress, which is quadratic in the stress tensor, in the curvature tensor. The linear term has this. This tensor by itself, actually, remember, it's a conserved tensor, okay? Whereas the normal part depends only on gradients of the curvature. Okay? So what can we say about it? That the tangential stresses are not isotropic. It's not a perfect fluid if there's bending energy, okay? The other thing about it is that this tensor is a quadratic function of the curvature tensor. So basically the lines of tangential stress, in other words, the directions along which stress is maximum and minimum, coincide with the lines along which curvature is maximum and minimum. That's not at all obvious any other way, okay? There's a fact that comes out. And also, the principal stresses, the values of the stress, are just quadratic functions of the principal curvatures, okay? Another thing you can see here is that if we forget about the constraints, these two terms, okay, we just look at the tangential stress. And suppose we're on a sphere, okay? Remember that the problem is scale invariant. If I'm on a sphere, in a sphere, the curvature tensor is just proportional to the metric tensor, okay? And C is a constant. The stress is zero. But unless there are constraints, there's no stress in the sphere. It just sits there, okay? It's the constraints which give stress to the system. And also, the last point is that the normal stresses are associated only with curvature gradients. There's a nice point here, because it's funny, because if I look at the conservation, though, here about it, a Laplace force, looking at a closed vesicle, there's a difference in pressure across it, okay? So the divergence of the stress is proportional to the Laplace pressure, okay? I have three conservation laws here, but for each component of F, there's a conservation law, whereas I have only one equilibrium condition, so there appears to be a discrepancy in the counting, okay? So how do you reconcile the two? So if I go again, I go back to this expansion of the stress tensor, okay? I can look at the normal and the parallel projections of this equation, of the conservation law, okay? The normal projection gives me this, okay? Remember that the normal stress is a gradient of the curvature, so then we get a Laplacian of the curvature. The tangential stress is a quadratic in the curvature, so we get a cubic in the curvature. This equation reproduces the shape equation, okay? On the other hand, we get another equation. And these are consistency conditions on the tangential and the normal stresses, okay? If we had added surface degrees of freedom, for example, say we wanted to model tilt. So we put some kind of surface vector field, MA, okay? Then this equation would actually reproduce the Euler-Lagrange equations for the surface degrees of freedom. But in a purely geometrical model where I don't include surface degrees of freedom, this is just, it's true, it's independent of the Euler Lagrange equations. It's true in general, it's just a structural relationship, okay? Consistency condition. The other point is that whereas this equation has an isodivergence form, when we actually take the projections of the equation, we mutilate the divergence, okay? This is divergence. This is highly non-divergent. So, in fact, if you look at the shape of the equation, it doesn't look like a divergence at all. But lo and behold, it is. Okay. So, to go back back to now that we're looking at the same interaction between two particles against two particles. We have the same contour, okay? Again, by symmetry, the force has to be along the x-axis, okay? This time it's rather more complicated. If there's tension, the gap would be proportional to the added length along the part of the contour on the axis of symmetry, okay? But there'll also be a term which is the integral of the difference of the curvatures squared along that axis, okay? What is the difference of the curvature? C curve is the curvature in this direction. It's a measure of how much it's curving in that direction. C parallel is a measure of the curvature in that direction, okay? So it's 1 over the radius of the curvature in that direction. Okay. So one cannot make a clean prediction, but this is already quite interesting. It means that depending on the geometry of the particles, how long they are, okay, we can have either attraction or repulsion, okay? But one thing can be said, if we make the particles long, turn them, instead of having spheres as we showed in that illustration, we turn them into cylinders, okay? And this term is zero. And if they're cylinders, this curvature goes to zero. If they're cylinders, this curvature is flat along here, okay? And we just get this term here. We just get the curvature, the perpendicular curvature. And that's always negative. So the interaction between two cylinders always repel, okay? So again, if one wants to, the only calculations done were done by Feikel and Helfrich and others. Yes?
So your cylinders are parallel to the surface, yes?
Yes, yes.
What happens if they are perpendicular to the surface?
That'd be very different. That'd be a very different case. That'd be more the generic case, okay? We couldn't make any simple claim, but even still, it's a very simple expression.
You're saying in the generic case, it's really whether C parallel.
That's right, and one would need the boundary conditions.
You have to actually look at the details.
That's right. One needs the details.
Answer.
But on the other hand, what I can say is that if you try to evaluate, we've got this far without having to know the geometry everywhere. If you want to evaluate the energy, we need the geometry everywhere, and we wouldn't have a hope in hell of getting anywhere. We have a clean expression.
But
if one
that,
one uses
for bending,
that
interactions needed by bending could attract or repel.
That's right,
bending.
Exactly, and that's why, in some sense, if proteins use membranes to talk to each other, they can do very, very complicated things. This is just looking at two particles, okay? What happens with three or more particles? They can do an enormously long, sort of a complicated dance, okay? And things don't add pairwise. So, in fact, people have looked at this. This is something I'm paralyzed at. I'm sort of handicapped because I don't do numerical work, okay? But I know that Marcus is looking at some of these things now, okay? But this, in some sense, how would you use this? I think what you would do is you would use some numerical thing, use triangulations or phase fields or some other way to determine what the profile is, and then use these expressions to determine what the forces are. So in other words, it's far more efficient. If I want to evaluate energy, I have to do a double integral and then differentiate it. Here I have to do a single integral of no differentiations. Far more efficient numerically. And it also tells us a lot more about the system. Now for something totally different, okay? Here's a formula we probably all learned in sort of freshman calculus, okay? If I have a closed surface and I want to determine what the volume is, okay? I can use Gauss's theorem, okay? So basically I have a result that if I have vector in space, and I look at the divergence of that, it's 3, okay?
There's a question about the closed surface assumption. Have your results so far assumed you always have a closed surface?
No,
or
not
it also applies
not
to a membrane patch, right?
Membrane patch, that's right. Those membranes are asymptotically flat.
Okay, but for the volume...
Okay, now I want to say something about, because there's a curiosity about volume. If I have a class force, there's something interesting. It looks like we have a source for the conservation law. It looks like it mutilates a lot of these sort of line integrals. So if we have a sort of, well, I can sort of deform the contour. I want to show you that you can. Okay? So if I use the fact that the divergence vector is 3, I wrote D here for D dimensions, okay? Then I just use Gauss's theorem to turn the integral of the volume over the volume into the surface integral. Okay? And so the nice thing here is that if the surface is closed, then this expression, so obviously it's invariant under translations, okay? So this tells me immediately that the integrated normal over a closed surface is zero, okay? Now this doesn't identify what I'm looking for, okay? But what it does do, it tells me that the normal must be a divergence itself, okay? Integrate over a closed surface. So the normal is the divergence of a stress-like object. And here's the stress-like object, okay? So we can always, so that the Laplace force is proportional to the normal vector. And I can always write the normal vector itself as a stress-like, as a divergence of stress. So I can always bring the Laplace pressure over to the left-hand side of the equation and write it as a conservation law. Okay, the price is, but it's not really a price, is that the new stress is manifestly dependent on the position. X appears in here. Nowhere else did X appear explicitly in our expression. Okay? That sounds like sort of something awful. Let me show you that actually sort of has nice features. Okay, so this is what I said. If I know the stress, can I say something nice about the geometry? Okay, so let me simplify things. So instead of looking at membranes, let me look at elastic curves on a plane. Okay, so I look at a closed elastic curve. Okay, Euler. This is the problem studied by Euler. Okay. So bending into the curvature of a curve on the plane. Okay, and I want to add analogs of the constraints for the membrane. I want to say that the length of this curve is fixed, okay? And also the closed area of the curve is fixed, okay? So I can now just step down the dimension of things and write down what the tension, stress tensor now, it's a tension in the loop. And there it is. There's a tangential part and there's a normal part, okay? And it's conserved. Here is a Laplace pressure given by the multiplier implementing the constraint on the area. Okay? So if I do that, I get immediately the shape equation is just a very, very simple equation in terms of arc length. Prime here refers to derivative with respect to arc length. It's curvature, second derivative curvature, plus a cubic in curvature. And that has a first integral. So you see immediately that the curvature along the loop is given by elliptic integrals, elliptic functions. So one would think, if I want to get the curve itself, I have to integrate the curvature twice. Okay. But lo and behold, you don't have to do that. Now let me show you how that works. Okay. That if I rewrite the normal here as a divergence, in this case it's just a derivative with respect to arc length. Okay. And I that means I can put this derivative over here, then I have derivatives on both sides, so I can integrate it up. Okay. So I have this, but this is some constant vector, okay? So this effective stress, respective tension, is constant along the loop, okay? But now what I can do is I can use symmetry. I can say that I have a configuration, okay? And I can always center the loop so that x dot t is zero, where the curvature is at maximum or minimum, okay? I can always do that. That tells me that I can always set this constant to zero. If that's true, then this coefficient to zero and that coefficient, these are orthogonal vectors, this coefficient to zero, this coefficient to zero, okay? So this is an entry, and so is this, okay? So I know what the two projections of x are, okay? So I can add them to get what x squared is. And what we find is that x squared is given locally by the curvature, okay? So curiously, one can actually, I like to think of it as more than a curiosity, okay? Because if something like this holds for two-dimensional membranes, I think it's quite, has far-reaching consequences. It might be an artifact of the fact that we're working with curves and it has nice first integrals, etc., okay? But a partial analog of this is true for higher dimensional objects, okay? But you see the difference, what's true here? So the position is given by the curvature, not by two integrals of the curvature, okay? It's quite unexpected, okay? So that's sort of mathematics motivated by biology. I don't know, because this is the home of level sets, okay? I sort of feel that I should say something, okay? Actually, I tread dangerously here, okay? But anyway, so I can also describe a surface, okay, in space, in terms of level sets. I have a function, basically phi in terms of level sets of a function. So phi of x is about the normal, the gradient normalized, and then the mean curvature is given by the divergence of the normal in this language. This divergence now is a divergence in space. Okay, so I can write down the bending energy. Basically, here I think an f of the curvature. But this bending energy is its curvature squared. This is what the so-called variant of the co-area formula. Looks sort of, but Levinson people would know all about it. Okay, but then the point is that we're going to look at the deformations of H correspond. A deformation surface now going to be described by deformations, level set function. Okay, so I can look at it how H responds to deformation of the level set. Okay, and because of translation invariance, again, we know that it's Euler Lagrange derivative has to be a spatial divergence this time. Okay, and once we do the calculation, here's the spatial divergence. Actually, one of the nice things, this is a result I thought was sort of cute, okay, is that I know that the Euler Lagrange derivative of mean curvature is Gaussian curvature, okay? So if f is mean curvature, it's Euler Lagrange is Gaussian curvature. But this tells me that Gaussian curvature can always be written as a spatial divergence, okay? It cannot be written as a surface divergence, okay? So one could use level set language, the alternative. Now, instead of having forces in terms of integrals along contours, we'd actually have forces as integrals along pillboxes around the surface. Okay, so let me close the show. Okay, so anyway, this is a problem. I don't know, it's not very close to biology. I'm a sort of a newcomer to this game that I'm learning. So this problem is a geometrical field theory. Okay, and I think that the appropriate language study it is differential geometry, every bit as much as it is in relativity or in string theory. Okay, and even though there is an activation barrier here, the ideas and implementing them is actually quite simple. And particularly, it should be easy to implement within a numerical procedure. Okay, also, to show that I was listening to David, these are the symmetries of the free energy are properties of the system. Okay, at least on this scale. Okay. For example, the invariance under translations implies the existence of a conserved stress sensor. It's something useful to know. It's not just a formal abstract thing. Okay? So also the take-home message, the geometry of the surface tells what the stresses are. Okay? And the interactions between particles are given as line integrals of the stress sensor. Okay? So basically just looking at the geometry tells us what the forces are on the membrane. One would like to think this might be useful for looking at something like the Golgi complex. We have this complicated thing and it's been held by microtubules. Okay? By somehow doing integrals of the geometry, just know what the stress is, or we'll be able to say where the microtubules are actually. I don't know whether that can be actually implemented in practice. Okay? So now I'd like to my collaborators, my co-workers at Ricardo Calavilla in Mexico, and that's both Ricardo and Chris Christomalakis in Mexico, Marcus De Cerno, student Martin Buller. Thank you.